In my younger years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that has opened up many curious natures to me and also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores. After boasting this way of my tolerance, I come to the admission that it has a limit. When I came home from the East Coast last autumn, I felt that I wanted no more privileged glimpses into the human heart. Only Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this story, was exempt from my reaction. There was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life. This responsiveness was an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness such as I've never found in any other person, and which it's not likely I shall ever find again. No, Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It is what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men. My family have been prominent, well-to-do people in this middle western city for three generations. The Carraways are something of a clan. I graduated from New Haven in 1915, just a quarter of a century after my father, and a little later I participated in that delayed Teutonic migration known as the Great War. I came back restless, so I decided to go east and learn the bond business. It was a matter of chance that I should have rented a house in one of the strangest communities in North America. It was on that slender, riotous island which extends itself due east of New York, and where there are, among other natural curiosities, two unusual formations of land. 20 miles from the city, a pair of enormous eggs, identical in contour and separated only by a courtesy bay, jut out into the great wet barnyard of Long Island Sound. I lived at West Egg, the less fashionable of the two. My house was at the very tip, only 50 yards from the Sound, and squeezed between two huge places that rented for 12 or 15,000 a season. The one on my right was a colossal affair by any standard, in more than 40 acres of lawn and garden. It was Gatsby's mansion. My own house was an eyesore, but it was a small eyesore, and I had a view of the water, a partial view of my neighbor's lawn, and the consoling proximity of millionaires. All for $80 a month. Across the courtesy bay, the white palaces of fashionable East Egg glittered along the water, and the history of the summer really begins on the evening I drove over there to have dinner with the Tom Buchanans. Daisy was my second cousin once removed, and I'd known Tom in college. His family were enormously wealthy. Even in college, his freedom with money was a matter for reproach. Why they came east, I don't know. They had drifted here and there unrestfully wherever people played polo and were rich together. This was a permanent move, said Daisy over the telephone, but I didn't believe it. And so it happened that on a warm, windy evening, I drove over to East Egg. Their house was even more elaborate than I expected, a cheerful red and white Georgian colonial mansion overlooking the bay. The front was broken by a line of French windows, glowing now with reflected gold and wide open to the warm, windy afternoon. Tom Buchanan, in riding clothes, was standing with his legs apart on the front porch. He had changed since his New Haven years. Now he was a sturdy, straw-haired man of 30, with a rather hard mouth and a supercilious manner. We walked through a high hallway into a bright, rosy-colored space, fragilely bound into the house by French windows at either end. The windows were ajar and gleaming white against the fresh grass outside. A breeze blew through the room, blue curtains in at one end and out the other like pale flags, twisting them up toward the frosted wedding cake of the ceiling. The only completely stationary object was an enormous couch on which two young women were buoyed up as though upon an anchored balloon. They were both in white, and their dresses were rippling and fluttering as if they had just been blown back in after a short flight around the house. Then there was a boom as Tom Buchanan shut the rear windows, and the caught wind died, and the curtains and the two young women ballooned slowly to the floor. The younger of the two was a stranger to me. She was extended full length at her end of the divan, completely motionless and with her chin raised a little. The other girl, Daisy, made an attempt to rise. Then she laughed, and I laughed too and came forward into the room. She held my hand for a moment, looking up into my face, promising that there was no one in the world she so much wanted to see. That was the way she had. She hinted in a murmur that the surname of the other girl was Baker. Miss Baker's lips fluttered. She nodded at me almost imperceptibly. My cousin began to ask me questions, and I told her how I had stopped off in Chicago for a day on my way east, and how a dozen people had sent their love through me.
"Do they miss me?" she cried.
"The whole town is desolate. All the cars have the left rear wheel painted black as a mourning wreath, and there's a persistent wail all night long along the North Shore."
"How gorgeous! Let's go back, Tom, tomorrow."
She added, "You ought to see the baby." "I'd like to."
"She's asleep. She's 3 years old."
At this point, Miss Baker yawned and with a series of rapid, deft movements stood up.
"I'm stiff. I've been lying on that sofa for as long as I can remember."
I looked at Miss Baker. I enjoyed looking at her. She was a slender, small-breasted girl with an erect carriage. It occurred to me now that I had seen her, or a picture of her, somewhere before.
"You live in West Egg," she remarked. "You must know Gatsby."
"Gatsby?" demanded Daisy. "What Gatsby?" Before I could reply that he was my neighbor, dinner was announced. Wedging his tense arm under mine, Tom Buchanan compelled me from the room as though he were moving a checker to another square. Slenderly, languidly, their hands set lightly on their hips, the two young women preceded us out onto a rosy-colored porch, open toward the sunset, where four candles flickered on the table in the diminished wind.
"We ought to plan something," yawned Miss Baker, sitting down at the table as if she were getting into bed.
"All right," said Daisy. "What'll we plan?"
She turned to me helplessly.
"What do people plan?"
Almost immediately the telephone rang and the butler came and murmured something close to Tom's ear. Tom frowned, pushed back his chair, and without a word went inside. As if his absence quickened something within her, Daisy leaned forward.
"I love to see you at my table, Nick. You remind me of a rose, an absolute rose, doesn't he?"
She turned to Miss Baker for confirmation. Then suddenly she threw her napkin on the table and excused herself and went into the house. Miss Baker and I exchanged a short glance consciously devoid of meaning. I was about to speak when she sat up alertly and said, "Shh." A murmur was audible in the room beyond, and Miss Baker leaned forward, unashamed, trying to hear.
"Is something happening?" I inquired.
"You mean to say you don't know? I thought everybody knew. Tom's got some woman in New York. She might have the decency not to telephone him at dinner time, don't you think?"
Almost before I had grasped her meaning, there was the flutter of a dress and the crunch of leather boots, and Tom and Daisy were back at the table.
"It couldn't be helped," cried Daisy.
She sat down, and the telephone rang inside, startlingly. Daisy shook her head decisively at Tom. Among the broken fragments of the last 5 minutes at table, I was conscious of wanting to look squarely at everyone and yet to avoid all eyes. Inside, the crimson room bloomed with light. Tom and Miss Baker sat at either end of the long couch, and she read aloud to him from the Saturday Evening Post.
"To be continued," she said, tossing the magazine on the table, "in our very next issue."
She stood up.
10 o'clock. Time for this good girl to go to bed."
"Jordan's playing in the golf tournament tomorrow," explained Daisy, "over at Westchester."
"Oh, you're Jordan Baker."
I knew now why her face was familiar. Its pleasing, contemptuous expression had looked out at me from many pictures of the sporting life.
"Good night," she said. "Wake me at 8, won't you? Good night, Mr. Carraway. See you anon."
Of course you will, confirmed Daisy. In fact, I think I'll arrange a marriage. Come over often, Nick, and I'll sort of, oh, fling you together and all that sort of thing.
Good night, called Miss Baker from the stairs. I haven't heard a word. She's a nice girl, said Tom after a moment. They oughtn't to let her run around the country this way.
Who oughtn't to? Inquired Daisy.
Her family.
Her family is one aunt about 1,000 years old. Besides, Nick's going to look after her, aren't you, Nick? She's going to spend lots of weekends out here this summer. I think the home influence will be very good for her.
Daisy and Tom looked at each other for a moment in silence.
A few minutes later, I got up to go home. They came to the door with me and stood side by side in a cheerful square of light. As I started my motor, Daisy called,
Wait, I forgot to ask you something, and it's important. We heard you were engaged to a girl out west.
It's a libel. I'm too poor. Of course, I knew what they were referring to, but I wasn't even vaguely engaged. The fact that gossip had published the banns was one of the reasons I'd come east. I had no intention of being rumored into marriage.
Their interest rather touched me and made them less remotely rich. Nevertheless, I was confused and a little disgusted as I drove away. Seemed to me that the thing for Daisy to do was to rush out of the house, child in arms. When I reached my estate at West Egg, I ran the car under its shed and sat for a while on an abandoned grass roller in the yard. The silhouette of a moving cat wavered across the moonlight, and turning my head to watch it, I saw that I was not alone. 50 feet away, a figure had emerged from the shadow of my neighbor's mansion. Something in the secure position of his feet upon the lawn suggested that it was Mr. Gatsby himself. Suddenly he stretched out his arms toward the dark water in a curious way, and, far as I was from him, I could have sworn he was trembling. I glanced seaward and distinguished nothing except a single green light, minute and far away, that might have been the end of a dock. When I looked once more for Gatsby, he had vanished, and I was alone again in the unquiet darkness.